Armena Watch, der Talk.
Herzlich willkommen, werte Zuschauer, bei unserem MENA Talk. Es ist mir eine große Freude, heute David Harris als Gast begrüßen zu dürfen. David Harris hat mit Unterbrechung seit 1979 für das American Jewish Committee gearbeitet, dessen Geschäftsführer er auch 32 Jahre lang gewesen ist, von 1990 bis 2022. Im Laufe seiner Karriere hat David Harris unter anderem in den frühen 70er Jahren in Moskau als Lehrer gearbeitet, wo er dann begann, sich für die Ausreise sowjetischer Juden aus der Sowjetunion eben zu engagieren. Das hat ihn prompt Gefängnisse in Moskau von innen kennenlernen lassen. Für seine Arbeit in seiner langen Karriere wurde er mit vielen Auszeichnungen bedacht. Vermutlich keine war allerdings ehrenvoller als der Umstand, dass Shimon Peres ihn einmal als den Außenminister des jüdischen Volkes bezeichnet hat. Es ist uns also eine große Freude und Ehre, David Harris begrüßen zu dürfen. Mr. Harris, welcome and thank you once again very much for taking the time to talk to us. Let us start maybe with the headline of the day. It seems as if Hamas and Israel have agreed on an exchange of sorts. Israel will release 150 Palestinians from Israeli prisons in return for Hamas releasing about or around 50 of the more than 230 Israeli hostages still in Gaza. And apparently a four-day ceasefire is to start tomorrow at 10 a.m. And as I read just a couple of minutes ago, a second round of exchange is going to follow or is planned to follow later on in the month. What do you think of this deal?
First of all, Florian, please allow me to thank MENA Watch for this opportunity and offer apologies. I speak some German, but if this were conducted in German, it would be a very short a very short program. So apologies for having to speak in English. Although I have to add, I am an Austrian citizen, which happened just a few years ago and is a separate story if we have time. I completely defer to the Israeli government on the hostage deal. I can imagine it was a very difficult decision for this or any government to make, because it entails an indirect negotiation with Hamas, not the first one, by the way, but nonetheless, very much in the public eye. It very much runs against the Israeli military doctrine of no concessions on hostage taking. It entails a ceasefire, allegedly a ceasefire in place, but with Hamas, one never knows what will actually happen. So there were a lot of difficult decisions, but in the Jewish religion, I'm not even speaking now about Israeli domestic politics, the redemption of the captives, in Hebrew, pikuach nefesh, is the highest value in Judaism. For that purpose, one can violate the Shabbat or any of the other rules and regulations of the Jewish people. So this is the redemption of the captives, the beginning, and there is no higher value. So in the end, this is, I think, what dictated the Israeli government decision.
I know that in recent years you've been very active in the area of Israeli Arab rapprochement. Keyword Abraham Accords, of course. What impact do you think has the war had, or will the war have, on Israel's relationship with the moderate Arab states?
I think it's an important question. Maybe I'm mixing wishful thinking with analytical thinking here, but I do note that in the recent Arab League meeting, where there was an effort to try and punish Israel and call on countries to sever their ties, there were 9 Arab countries that refused to go along. And that's interesting because it's not just the 6 in the circle of peace. Egypt, Jordan, plus the 4 Abraham Accords countries, but also reportedly Saudi Arabia, Mauritania, and Djibouti. So I think that in itself is quite significant. I don't think, having been involved in this process for many years, that the Arab countries got involved to advance the Palestinian issue. That's not why they became involved with Israel, not at all. In fact, many of them, at least in my presence, have very little interest in the Palestinian issue and very little confidence today in Palestinian leadership. They engaged with Israel for other reasons. Those reasons are every bit as compelling today. They focus on security, in particular the threat of Iran and Iran's satellites, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza, to some extent in the West Bank. They were also motivated by technology, they were motivated as well by an eye on Washington. Now, none of those things have changed, Florian. So I think the longer-term calculations of the circle of peace remain the same. They may have to go through a period of saying things in public and voting at the United Nations, which do not correspond with what they're saying and doing privately. That would not be new. But I think over time, the peace train goes forward. And I'm still optimistic that we will move from 6 countries in the Arab world to 7, to 8, yes, to 9, and who knows in the years ahead.
I saw that you thanked President Biden on Twitter today for his support, or ex, formerly known as Twitter, today for his support for Israel. But am I wrong, or is the USA also slowly but surely beginning to increase pressure on Israel? Recently, they abstained from voting in the UN Security Council instead of vetoing a resolution calling for a ceasefire. Do you also think that they're starting to send out some mixed signals in direction Israel?
The reason I wrote that, that today, I still prefer to call it Twitter, but X. It sounds much harsher to the ear, X. But I wrote that because I really believe, and I say this as a complete nonpartisan, a total nonpartisan who has also criticized this administration and previous administrations when I thought it was appropriate. But I think the president's support for Israel from day one has been quite extraordinary. I think he's been under a lot of domestic pressure, especially in his own party, Democratic Party, particularly the left wing of the Democratic Party. I think he has withstood that pressure as best he could. He has sent 2 aircraft carrier groups. He has sent additional weapons, resupply of weapons and spare parts. I think his record has been very strong. If we're holding him to a perfect record, I don't know of any politician or government that necessarily has a perfect record. It's an excellent record. And as we begin to hear the story, Florian, of the backstory about the hostage deal, the U.S. was very committed to helping ensure a hostage deal. And by the way, it's often forgotten. It shouldn't be. There are many Americans who are being held hostages, as there are citizens of other countries besides Israel. So while this is often portrayed as Israeli victims of Hamas terror and Israeli hostages of Iran of Hamas terror, those are both inaccurate statements. The more precise statements are Israeli and dozens of other nationalities, both murdered as well as injured, as well as kidnapped.
Let's stay with the two parties in America right now. What is going on in the two parties in respect to Israel at the moment? You already mentioned the Democratic Party and this left wing, very much anti-Israeli wing of the party. They seem to be rather quiet for a while after October 7th. And there were some surprising news that I read, at least. I read that Bernie Sanders supported the Israeli war and said there is no choice than to destroy Hamas militarily. But they're getting louder again, aren't they?
You know, yes and no. And one should not confuse noise level with numbers. They're very noisy. They're very active on social media. They give the impression, therefore, that they represent a much larger political voice than is in fact the case. And Florian, if you look at the various votes in the United States Congress since October the 7th, you'll see that there is overwhelming support in the Congress for Israel and for the U.S.-Israel relationship. And this noisy group that's all over social media is not representing large numbers in the U.S. Congress. That's clear. And look, on top of that, perhaps the noisiest of them, Rashida Tlaib from the state of Michigan, was actually censored. I think it's only the 26th time in well over 200 years that a member of the United States Congress was actually censured. And she was censured for her defamatory statements, for her discredited statements. For example, she was perpetuating the lie, and yes, it is a lie, that Israel struck the hospital in Gaza with missiles, that 500 people were killed. The United States government, her own party leader, Joe Biden, discredited those reports. The intelligence agencies did. Even various media outlets subsequently confirmed that Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PIJ, had fired or misfired those missiles that struck, by the way, not the hospital, but the parking lot, and apparently did not kill anywhere close to 500 people. But nonetheless, she persisted in this. And what she's really done is she's undermined her own case. So those people on the left who might have had a tendency to listen carefully to people like herself, I think are moving away because they can no longer trust her as a source, and for good reason.
So you think it looks as if the next presidential candidate will be the acting president as on the Democratic side. What will happen in the Republican Party, and what is going on within the Republican Party? I have a feeling that there are some isolationist trends getting stronger within the party. Do you think that there might be turning away from Israel in the future under whoever might be a coming Republican president?
Well, first of all, because I speak simply as an individual and not representing an organization today, I think it would be best for the United States if we moved beyond Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I believe I'm clearly in the majority, according to all the surveys, in that view. So there's nothing dramatic in saying that. The support for Israel and the Republican Party has been extremely strong without that dissenting block that you have in the Democratic Party. On the other hand, to your point, when it comes to Ukraine, it has been that isolationist bloc in the Republican Party that is of growing concern for those of us, I include myself, who believe that Ukraine is a national priority for America. So what you have, Florian, at least as I see it, is number one, you have two candidates who are likely to be running against each other next November, who are very unpopular nationally, even though Donald Trump continues to have good support within his own party. Number two, you have the anti-Zionist bloc of the Democratic Party, and many of them are anti-Zionist. And that's a concern, but they are a minority. And in the Republican Party, you have an isolationist wing, which I think is actually a bit larger and is largely focused now on Ukraine. And number three, to use a German word, more broadly, we have a Kulturkampf. I think that's before our very eyes in the United States, with two very different Weltanschauungs, two very different worldviews. Two very different views of America itself, of its history, of its founding mission, and it's being played out very much everywhere, Florian. And I don't quite see the pathway forward to reunite America and overcome this polarization. If I just may add, there was much discussion about polarization in Israel until October the 6th. And had we been having this discussion with MenaWatch October the 6th or 5th, your questions would have been about judicial reform and about the deep divisions and the future of democracy in Israel. On October 7th, all of that was forgotten. All of that was put in the past. And the most striking thing for me, which gives me such optimism about Israel, is that when the call for the mobilization of reserves was issued by the Israeli Defense Forces, 300,000 people were called up. 350,000 people showed up. And they showed up from everywhere in the world. If they were vacationing in Peru, if they were vacationing in India, where a lot of young Israelis like to spend time, they were on the first planes back. And this sense of the glue of Israel, that we are one when it comes to the national security of the country, and no one in Gaza, no one in Iran, no one in Lebanon should misunderstand our domestic debates. If the Iranian regime thought that we were weaker because of our domestic debates, they misunderstood us, because they don't understand democracy and they don't understand the Israeli spirit. And that's what I think they're learning again now in Gaza, in Lebanon, and Iran. Israel is much stronger, much more united, much more determined than they may have thought, especially in recent months.
Let's stay in the United States, maybe for a moment longer. Sure. We have seen and read reports about what is going on in the American universities at campuses all over the country. Pretty much the same that is happening in parts of Europe as well, with students and as well as some of faculty openly supporting Hamas and their war against Israel and their terrorism against Israel. How could have something like that have happened? How did we get there? I mean, this is the future elite of the United States of America who is turning against Israel and turning out in favor of a genocidal Islamist organization. So what is going on there?
You're absolutely right to ask the question and to express the concern. And I would say it is about Israel, but frankly, it's about much more than Israel. I think there's a desensitization to human life. I think that for many, there's a hatred of America that's also part of the equation. How do we get to a point where more than 30 student organizations at Harvard University, perhaps the most famous American school, within a day or two, blamed Israel for the genocidal attack on Israel on October the 7th? How did we get there? How could otherwise presumably intelligent students be unable or unwilling to make a moral, ethical, political distinction between an openly genocidal organization, and it is openly genocidal in that it calls for the eradication of the entire state? It has no interest, obviously, in a two-state solution or path to coexistence. And it also invokes a certain Muslim teachings calling for the annihilation of Jews. Find Jews wherever they may be, behind the rock, behind the tree, and kill them. How could they endorse this and at the same time oppose a democratic, pluralistic nation which did not initiate the attack on October the 7th? And which experienced, as I think everyone on this call knows full well, unprecedented murder, beheading, rape, gang rape, mutilation, kidnapping from the fetus to babies under 1 year old, all the way to Holocaust survivors. How could these students have, and some faculty have become so desensitized to human life? And I think for me, Florian, the answer is twofold, and I can't say this with full confidence. But first of all, American universities have increasingly become, if you will, invaded by a woke culture, a woke philosophy, a cancel culture, an intersectional culture. That these are all sort of terms of the day, but that increasingly divides the world between the powerful and the powerless, between the oppressor and the oppressed. It creates very simple binary equations. And according to those simple binary equations, Jews, who not so long ago were considered Untermenschen because they were poisoning the Aryan white race, the Aryan white race, are now being portrayed as embodying, symbolizing the evils of the white race, that is, of white privilege, of white power, of white wealth, of white success. We are now the poster children for whiteness, when not so long ago, we were the genocidal target for being sub-white or non-white or poisoning or threatening the whites. Number one and number two, like many countries in Western Europe, especially Florian, also Australia, Canada, the immigration trends have dramatically changed our population mix. And here one has to be very careful, and I am, not to suggest that this large Muslim migration to the West and to the United States is solely responsible. But within that population, it's clear, and it's seen at every university in America, that there are jihadists, Islamists, who have interpreted their faith and their religion to call for Israeli annihilation and Jewish murder. And you put these two groups together, the woke insanity and the jihadist momentum. And of course, the irony of that, what's called the Red-Green Alliance, the irony is that if Hamas ever ruled Harvard University, think about that one for a moment, or any of the other universities, their first targets, their very first targets would be the woke culture, not the far right, because the far right at Harvard University is so tiny, you need a microscope to find it. But those who advocate for LGBTQ rights, those who want freedom not of religion, but from religion, people who speak about sexual freedom, dissent, freedom of protest, freedom of assembly, go down the path, they would be the first targets. But history has shown us more than once, Florian, that these become the useful idiots of the extreme. They haven't learned the lessons of history.
So one of the lessons of history that one can mention and think of is certainly that when people proclaim that they're intent on wiping out a whole nation, like for Iran, for example, Iran is doing in vis-à-vis Israel, one should believe their claims and one should take them seriously. And of course, you mentioned Iran already before. There is still one question looming over everything else in the Middle East, and that is, of course, the Iranian nuclear program. You said you are fully supportive of President Biden in respect to his support of Israel. What about his policy and the policy of the Biden administration in respect to the Iranian nuclear program? Do you also really believe his claims that under his watch, United States will never allow Iran to get a hand at the bomb?
I want to comment first, if I may, Florian, on your transition point about the failure of imagination when people say they want to kill you. Because for me, this is very central to my own outlook on life. It shaped the way I see things, and your audience should understand that. If I may be personal for a moment, my father is from Vienna. My father was a student at the Institute of Chemistry of the university at the age of 16 in 1936. In 1938, after the Anschluss, after Kristallnacht and the Anschluss, my father was expelled from the university as a Jew. Parenthetically, in 1975, the university invited my father to come back and gave him an honorary PhD, an honorary doctorate, for work he was doing on the synthesis of the heavy hydrogen atom. This was the beginning of atomic physics. Because of the insanity that engulfed Austria, like Germany, Austria probably lost a Nobel Prize winner in my father. But my father understood something. When people say they're going to kill you, and they have the power that they've gathered, take them seriously. Adolf Hitler, as I'm sure this audience knows, in 1924, wrote his manifesto in the Landsberg prison explaining his worldview. When he came to power 9 years later, on January 30th, 1933, too many so-called experts, Florian, in governments, in think tanks, in universities, in the media, chose not to take him seriously, arguing that the responsibility of government would necessarily moderate Hitler and the Nazi regime. How wrong they were. My wife is a forgotten refugee. I'm not even sure that everyone in this audience understands the term or the reference, but too few people know that there were two refugee populations as a result of Arab-Israeli wars beginning in 1947-48. One we hear about day in and day out, the Palestinian refugee population, as it's now in the fourth generation, at least. And the other were Jews from Arab countries, including my wife, who until the age of 16 and a half lived in Libya as a second or third class citizen. And my wife, I have to say, on October the 7th, experienced for the first time post-traumatic stress disorder, which she had not since 1967, when she heard about Israeli women, young women, being grabbed, being raped, being mutilated, being kidnapped. My wife and her seven siblings were this close to the same fate in June 1967. They were saved by an act of, I'll say, God. Other Jews in Libya were not saved. So my wife doesn't have a PhD in history from Harvard University. She has a PhD in history from life. My father had a PhD in history from life. And my mother was a victim both of communism, she was born in Moscow, and then of fascism when they moved to Paris and the Nazis occupied. So I grew up in a home which took history very seriously, and not just the books on the shelves, but the realities of life. So when you say, people say we want to kill you, whether it was Hitler in 1924, or whether it's Hamas today or Iran today, in this Jewish family, I take them very seriously. And to your question about Joe Biden, I thought that Barack Obama in 2015 made a terrible strategic miscalculation. I recall that the deal was announced in Vienna, back to Vienna, on July the 14th, 2015. I was very much involved in the discussions up to that day, met several times with John Kerry, who was then Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, who was the chief negotiator for the United States, and others, both European and American. And I heard from their lips, not from third and fourth parties, but from their lips, how they saw this deal unfolding. And I believed it was a house of cards, because I heard, among other things, their view that President Rouhani of Iran at the time was potentially the next Mikhail Gorbachev, and that Foreign Minister Zarif of Iran was potentially the next Edward Shevardnadze. Now, of course, Gorbachev and Shevardnadze oversaw the end of the Soviet Union. And the belief here was that a deal was not just transactional, which, Florian, they're now trying to claim that's all it was transactional. It was not. They viewed it as potentially transformational, reimagining the Middle East, reimagining the balance of power, curbing the extremism emanating from Iran. And they negotiated a deal that was full of the holes in a Swiss cheese. I don't have to critique the deal now. I'm sure the MetaWatch community knows it well. But they were weak on ballistic missiles. They were weak on the expiration at times. There were too many holes in the inspection regime. I can keep going. The problem is, Florian, that the current Biden administration includes many veterans, not just of the Obama administration, but of the deal itself, including the then vice president, the now president. And their fate in history, when the history will be written, depends in large degree on being vindicated for their decision on Iran. So rather than move away from the 2015 decision, I think too many of them are holding on to it in order to, if you will, ensure their place in history. From my point of view, the deal was, as I said, much too weak, much too porous in 2015, and Iranian behavior in the last 8 years only underscores the point. And I would just finish by saying, Florian, that if someone's going to be teaching negotiation strategy, whether at the law school in Vienna or the law school here in New York or the diplomacy school, the Diplomatic Academy, I think in the first Bezirk in Vienna, as I remember, near to Bramsplatz, I forgot which, is that the first Bezirk? I'm not sure.
Well, today it's in the fourth district, the Diplomatic Academy, but yeah, it's
the fourth district. But my point is not my bad geography of Vienna, but I would teach about how Iran, with a weak hand, managed to outmaneuver the U.S., the EU, Britain, France, and Germany with a strong hand to play. I wish it could be taught the other way around, meaning how you defend a strong hand and get a strong result. But in this case, unfortunately, I think the lesson of the class would be, here is how a country with a weak hand, which had punishing sanctions, was facing low oil prices on which its revenue was largely based, and managed to outmaneuver the strong hand, with the U.S. administration coming to people like us directly and saying, this is the best deal we could get. And the alternative, they told us, is war. So they created this false binary choice. You want this deal, the best we can get, or are you a warmonger? And of course, I didn't for a moment believe that there was that binary choice. There was a third option, which was to negotiate far, far more aggressively and not to succumb to the bluffs, the brilliant bluffing of the Iranians, the way they very cleverly play with Zarif, so fluent in English, so knowledgeable about the West and America in particular. together with John Kerry and Federica Mogherini. I mean, all of these scenes of this camaraderie, it seemed, you know, we're going to get this done together. And so look where we are. So Iran is closer than ever. I have no doubt, Florian, that if we have not already reached the point, we will see the point where Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, Turkey are seriously considering their own nuclear plans. We run a major risk of escalation in the region. And meanwhile, Iran continues with its tentacles in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen. And that's just for starters, Florian.
Yeah. It's a very, very complicated situation. And the problem, of course, for the United States is even if the policy of the administration would be successful, it would not end in Iran not getting the bomb. So horrible situation. Well, I think we've stolen enough of your time. Thank you once again for having taken the time to be our guest. Thank you very much, Mr. Harris.
It's my pleasure. And thank you to MenaWatch for hosting me.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Eine Produktion von MenaWatch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns. Eine Produktion von MenaWatch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.